Paradigm Shifters, and Paradigm Shifters are people who are making a difference on the planet at this time, making a difference in the collective of our species, our collective consciousness. Something that we all know we're going to do is we're going to die. We're going to move to another realm, and we're going to make a ton of transitions throughout our lives, changing from one way of being to another, changing homes and stuff. Anyway, we have a wonderful, wonderful writer and presenter of Life as a Hospice Nurse and way more since the late 70s. And many of you know who she is, Maggie Callanan, author of Final Gifts, and her latest is Final Journeys. We're going to talk to her about what it is to talk to the dying, to be dying, to do all of the paperwork and all the legitimate stuff that everybody has to do when you're helping someone die or escorting them in the process, and who knows what else. So welcome to the show, Maggie, from the hot East Coast.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I'm delighted to join you from hot Cape Cod.
I heard it's 100 degrees in some parts of the country.
Unheard of here. But
is
we have it.
Oh, you have it, eh?
Yeah, we do. We're up in the high 90s. Very, very unusual for here, yes.
Wow, eh?
Yeah.
Well, welcome to the show, and I think that you told me that you started working with hospice or studying this subject as a nurse in the late 70s, is that right?
I did. I was. My background really is critical care, and in the 70s I was a young mother with two small children, and I took a break from the crisis that you deal with in critical care and worked at a university. During that time, a young student became a patient that I needed to follow. She was dying of cystic fibrosis, and she'd had a number of near-death experiences, and I sat hours and hours and hours with her, but during the nights, she just never seemed to sleep, and she changed my life. And when she did die in 73, I went searching for the better way. Uh-huh. And found hospice.
And was it through conversations with her? Is that what changed your life? Is it knowing her? Like, was she articulate about her process?
She was incredibly wise, as dying children are. She'd be very angry. I called her a child. She was 21, which back in the 70s was quite old for cystic fibrosis. Fortunately, that has changed. But she was a wise old soul and was on a path that was very clear. She knew she was dying. She knew all she needed to know about dying. She was one of a number of children in her family to die of cystic fibrosis. So she was very wise, and she felt very much that she was here to serve a purpose, and she wanted to finish her education and to deal with dying children. And you know, fortunately, she taught me how to listen, and because it was just so compelling being with her, and she changed my life.
Uh-huh.
She really did. So I knew there was a better way. Critical care, thank God for it. We rescue people. We save lives. We do amazing things. But when it comes to dying slowly of an illness, it's not always the best option or the gentlest option, shall I say. And I had never thought in those terms before. Being a critical care nurse, you know, I was leaping over stretchers and saving lives and all the high drama that you see on TV.
Mm-hmm. Like ER, that sort of thing.
Exactly, yes. And a lot of that's quite accurate. But
isn't there a feeling of failure, too, if someone dies?
Terrible. Terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, think for a moment of the ego.
Right.
you know,
of the medics and
Right, as though death only happens when we fail to do our job right.
Hmm.
As though there are not other forces at play.
So did your friend who was 21, did she kind of express the process of dying as a part of her soul's journey, as a part of her life this time?
Very much. She talked about her hopes and wishes and dreams. She talked about reuniting with her two sisters and brother who had predeceased her. She had a very strong faith, a very strong belief in God, and she felt very sure that she was going to a better place. But she was not always happy about leaving this place. She was 21. You know, she had buddies and college friends, and, you know, they got into trouble and did outrageous things. And, you know, she taught me the importance of living every minute until you die, rather than dying every minute until you die.
Mm. And there's a movie about that. I can't remember what it's called. A young girl who's dying, and I remember she was in love with a guy, and he couldn't bear the fact she was dying. He left, and then when he came back, she said, "You look at me as somebody who's dying, but I'm going to live till I die. Are you?
That's the secret. That's the secret, and that's a distinct choice.
Hmm.
It's a choice we all can make, and it's stunning how many are unable to make that choice without someone saying, "Why don't you choose to live every minute instead of die?" Because I think the expectation is, you know, once you've been given a terminal diagnosis, that all you do from that moment on is die little bits at a time.
And also, I want to say this, that I think people pull away from somebody.
Well, they don't know what to do. They don't know what to say. You know, we're, you know, in this country, we're fixers. You know, we either fix it or we throw it away and buy a new one. And, you know, we don't know what to do with certainly somebody we don't want to throw away and we'll never be able to replace with a new one, but we can't fix it. And that's very...
Well, do you think it comes from our culture where we just don't accept, we still don't, even after Kubler-Ross's work and yours and others, you know, we still don't accept it as a natural flow?
That's true to a point, but remember also that the more we learn about dying, and of course the way to learn about that is to spend as much time listening to dying people, the more we learn about them, the more we know what a complex journey this is. It's not simply the failure of medical science to keep us alive.
Hmm.
You know, we're multifaceted people, and every one of those aspects of us changes when we're dealing with facing our mortality. It's not just our physical body that's failing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's our intellect, it's our spirit, it's our hopes, our dreams, our role in the family, our role in the community, our job, you know, what we brought to the office, our dying ripples through all of those relationships.
It really does, doesn't it?
It does.
So what happened to you when you were touched by this young friend who was on such a journey? What happened to you? Did you leave critical care permanently?
I did. I left critical care permanently, and I think almost subconsciously, part of me has gone into hospice to pay penance for being such a hotshot ER nurse, you know, jumping over stretchers, and, you know, I knew all of my electrolytes, and I knew all of the, you know, I knew all the technology, and, you know, how to fix the EKG machine, and all of that sort of thing. I think I can say, I am justified in saying, and trust me, thank God for critical care. Please, anybody out there in the audience who's in critical care, we need you, and we support you, and nobody can do the job you do when it's appropriate. It's just not always appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But I really think that I, on some level, felt like I was doing penance for being such a hotshot, when basically, death is not for me to choose to fix or not. It is a process that I should be able to accompany.
Well, it's interesting because I would say to you then, if people come in, for example, to the ER,
mm-hmm.
how would you then change your approach to that? Would you ask them if they want to, you know what I mean? Would you ask them if they want to live? Would you feel out the situation empathically or intuitively? Or would
well,
you...
that would certainly be ideal, Veronica, but you know, you know, and the television doesn't lie about how busy emergency rooms are.
Right.
You know, oftentimes you barely remember the person's name while you're going from one crisis to another. And the kind of information that you need in shifting the paradigm needs to come in quiet, close contact times. And that's not a very good setting for that.
Mm-hmm.
Typically, when critically or when terminally ill people show up in the emergency room, they tend to show up often. Because
oh, really?
They're in pain, because their symptoms are out of control, because they are not in the proper hands.
Okay.
Because they are not receiving the medical care that's appropriate to their condition. And, you know, hospital...
So are there flags on their charts? Is there some way of knowing that?
Well, but, you know, there are also people who have a significant amount of denial, and no matter what you do, this is what they're going to do. And it's their right. It is their right.
Okay.
You know, people have the human right... to make awful choices, and they do. And it took me a very long time to realize that I was not put on this earth to convince them otherwise all the time. But I do believe in offering options, and I think one of my favorite terms and concepts is reframing.
Hmm.
You don't change the picture. All of the components are there. You don't change the devastating situation. But I can say... let me help you look at this a little bit differently.
Okay.
And then you choose which view helps.
Hmm.
But, you know,
coming
into a busy emergency room on a Saturday night, the opportunity or the possibilities of that happening are pretty slim. You know, the doctor may come in and say, you know, this is as much as we can do for you. You really need to call hospice, or you need to call the visiting nurses, or... you know, you need to call somebody who will bring you help in your home. You know, the old days of sort of trudging up to the hospital with your suitcase in hand and saying, "Hi, I'm dying and I need to check in now," are over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hospitals are designed to be institutions where something gets fixed.
Mm. So,
and you know, you are not fixable.
Right.
So maybe you're in a crisis that can be improved, or have a problem that can be fixed. But basically, it's extremely hard to end up being hospitalized for a long time because you're dying when there are other services available to you that are far more appropriate and far better.
So tell me about the emergence of that, talking about emergency. There was an emergence of the hospice movement that you
yeah.
were participating
yeah.
in the beginning. Did you know Elizabeth Kubler-Ross?
Did I know
her?
I'm sorry,
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross.
Oh yes, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, she. You know, when I do presentations, I stand up and say, "We just discovered dying in the 70s," which is true.
A new thing.
Yeah, which is true, because until Elizabeth Kubler-Ross sat and listened and learned from her patients, what a concept, okay?
Right.
Because typically you have a situation and your doctor comes and diagnoses it and tells you what to do and designs the plan.
Mm-hmm.
She completely changed that paradigm and said, "Tell me what you want. I'll give it to you and help me make the plan that suits your needs."
Oh, wow. So that
okay?
was a big shocker.
Mm-hmm. It's a shocker. And that's why hospice is so successful. We ask them what they want and we give it to them. Stunning.
Well, what a concept.
I know.
So you put on your wings and flew in from emergency to do the other side of the coin there, right?
I just knew that I had done a good job for the first half of my career,
mm-hmm.
but I wasn't where I belonged.
Okay.
And I loved I think in the first half of my career, I loved the technical challenge. And, it's kind of interesting because while I was writing Final Gifts, I worked for a hospice, but I also worked in an emergency room. Just because
oh, you
I
did
sort
both?
Of because I sort of, well, it was part-time, but I sort of missed the flavor and the drama, and you know, it really is fun to take those rubber gloves and blow them up so that they look like chickens and put little eyes and stuff on them and give them to children. Every now and then, it's nice to fix things.
That was part of the final gift. The final gift for people who don't know is a wonderful book with stories of people who are in transition and how to speak to them and so on. So I just wanted people to know what that was before we...
Well, it's the lessons from my finest teachers is what final gifts is. Every patient I ever take care of, I say, teach me. I'm the student. Yeah. What I learned from you, I promise to carry forward to make a journey easier for somebody else. And it is just stunning what people have taught me. And so I have promises to keep. I need to take those messages forward, which is what I've been doing ever since.
And so people say, isn't that really depressing?
Oh, golly, I could just... I'm not going to tell you what I could do. I mean, if people had any idea of the profound joy and satisfaction that I get from working with dying people, they just, no, it's not depressing. You know, I work with a unit of people. One person in that unit is dying. I'm equally interested and responsible to see that everybody in that unit gets through this really significant life event in as good shape as possible.
So that's kinfolk?
Sure. Whoever the family happens to be, whoever the caregivers, you know, that little children aren't frightened and they understand what's happening and that, you know, people are guided and guided toward having the satisfaction of having cared for someone they love so much. You know, it's life-changing. I mean, I've had family members say it's the hardest job I ever loved.
Oh, that's wonderful. When you say people are guided, do you mean from this side or do you mean from spirit people? Or?
Well, I like to think I have a lot of help. At this point, I have many more friends on whatever the other side is than I do here. I have passed the 2,000th mark.
Oh my.
Right. And so, you know, I'm hoping that they remembered I worked real hard and that they'll help me out now and then if I get into a bind.
Well, Maggie, what was it like at the beginning? Was it, of course, you'd already been with ER and critical care, so you
had seen plenty of death, but I had seen tragic, horrific death.
Right.
I hadn't seen death that was so peaceful and quiet that it happened while I was sitting on the chair next to the bed talking to the wife, and we just simply finally realized that he wasn't breathing anymore. I hadn't seen those kind of deaths.
Oh, my.
I hadn't seen those peaceful, what I call beautiful deaths.
Was there a big time of adjustment for you to go from one to the other to a different way of living?
It seems so very long ago because I've been doing this for so long. I just remember for a long time the back seat of my car was full of resource books. I laugh at it now, but that's... When I start a new job, the measure of my insecurity is by the number of books I have in the back seat of the car. You know, my drug PDR and my charts and my graphs and my tables. And, you know, basically that's not really what it was all about. It was all about going in with my blank paper and learning from my teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there was. I was impressed with my role of being responsible for people's comfort and responsible for quality life to the end. You don't get a second chance with a dying patient, one dying patient. And so I was very, concerned that, the first chance be the absolute best chance. But, you know, as I did it more, and it became like second nature. And then the more I learned from patients, the more I could carry forward. You know, they gave me the tools.
Well, tell me what kind of tools. Like, what did you learn from patients?
I learned that patients are not asking us to fix it. Do you know, Veronica, in all the time I've done this, I have never had a patient say, because I always say, if I had a magic wand, what would you have me do? I have never once had a patient say, take away this illness.
Oh, really?
Isn't that amazing?
Are they in an altered state?
No, perfectly clear. I mean, this is the way I start with people in the beginning, because I need to know their hopes and their dreams and their goals, because we're on a schedule now where we have a limited amount of time and we need to get these things taken care of. And
how long do you usually have? Like, are you invited in when they first know it's terminal, or when it's 6 months or 3 weeks?
You know, it sort of depends. I know most hospices, and I know this show is playing in Canada, and I think Canada is very similar. And Canada has a phenomenal hospice palliative care program. They really, truly do. I've had the great pleasure of speaking in Vancouver a few times, and I'm pretty dazzled. But typically, hospices take patients in at about the 6 month point. Now, none of us have a crystal ball and a magic calendar. You know, this is just done by certain criteria. The hospice and palliative care movement has taken most diseases and figured the trajectory and how long from this point does it take to get to that point. So we can talk in terms of weeks and months, certainly not days. Numbers, certainly not numbers. Mm-hmm. So ideally, that's the criteria, is about 6 months. But I had two patients, one that I took care of for 2 years and one that I took care of for 2.5 years.
Oh, my.
Yeah, well, we certainly aren't going to throw you out if you don't die on time.
That would be gain very, a lot by extending.
That would be
time.
Very rude, Veronica.
Excuse me, I'm trying to die fast. I can't get it done here.
No, because one patient had Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS,
mm-hmm.
Very slow progression, and as long as we could chart progression, she continued to be appropriate. Our problems in hospice come when patients come into us, and they're a mess of pain and nausea and constipation and all sorts of things out of control, and we work extremely aggressively to make them comfortable, and once we get them settled, they kind of improve. And then they sort of plateau, and then it's like, whoops, you know, now what do we do? And in the States, because we are mandated by Medicare to fulfill certain criteria, if a patient does not continue to deteriorate, we have to discharge them. I prefer to use the term go on hold. Mm-hmm. I like the imagery of my little button being red and blinking, and I'm right here when you need me, just push it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes with really good, appropriate medical care, patients improve.
Right.
And when that happens, then we need to say, you know, go forth and enjoy. And there have been times that we have strongly suggested the patients leave hospice to get curative care.
Hmm.
I mean, we are always monitoring that someone doesn't come in by accident who could have benefited by chemo or radiation or surgery or whatever.
Hmm.
I remember one of our doctors, almost, I don't mean a physical fight, but a verbal fight, that he was trying to convince her she needed to leave hospice, and she didn't want to leave because she liked us. And, you know, we made her feel so much better, and we made her get so much better, and that was the whole point. You know, you're so much better now, you probably could tolerate more treatment. And
yeah, I've heard a number of people who got better in hospice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what? I wonder if part of it is TLC, you know?
Well, I think we certainly pay a tremendous amount of attention. My first visit with hospice patients is typically about 3 hours.
Hmm.
And I mean, one of the things to me that gives me such joy in hospice is I'm allowed to choose what I need to do. I'm a guest in their home.
Hmm.
And I'm allowed to spend the amount of time that they need. Now, granted, I have other tasks I have to accomplish in my workday.
Hmm.
But
who are you employed by?
Who am I employed by now? Right this minute?
No, when a person's in a hospice, when you were being a hospice nurse, who employed you? Was it a hospital?
A hospice. Which was separate from a hospital.
Okay, so that's an actual company.
Yes, although some hospitals have hospice wings and some long-term care facilities have hospice wings. Hospices seem to be popping up all over the place. And, you know, I'll take this opportunity to say, be sure when you choose a hospice that it is a licensed, accredited hospice.
Mm.
you know, because we're a little disturbed by the sort of Fred and Harry type of hospices that are popping up here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Because to some, hospice is a bit of a trendy term.
Mm-hmm.
But licensed and accredited means they must follow the national or the state requirements. And, you know, certainly because you don't get a second choice, a second chance,
right,
you want to make sure you're in the very best hands.
And how do you train to be a hospice helper?
Well, you know, there wasn't any training when I started because hospice just came to the United States in the 70s from England. Dame Cicely Saunders came over to show us their model of care for the terminally ill. And then I joined it in 81. So it was still very new at the time that I joined it. And in fact, our hospice was one of the pilot programs that was chosen by Medicare to show them how we do the job and to justify what they should pay for and what they shouldn't. So basically, we were one of the 14 participating hospices in what was called the hospice Medicare benefit. Now, that's true for the United States. I'm not sure how all of that happens in Canada, because your health reimbursement is different than ours.
Right.
So, you know, hospices were independent companies. Many were branches of already existing home care companies like VNA, visiting mm-hmm. nurses. And the philosophy of the hospice care is family-centered home care. In other words, the vast majority of our patients are in their homes, in their beds, surrounded by their families, you know, riding their golf carts, you know, just doing their lives rather
and
than
they call you in?
Rather than moving into a building.
Mm.
A lot of hospices do have those buildings for critical care. But, for example, one of the programs that I was in, one of the biggest programs that I worked with for quite a few years, had a 14-bed inpatient separate standing building that was hospice, but we had 700 patients. So that gives you an idea of how many people ever went into this building rather than being at home.
Mm.
And so, yes, the family would call. Anybody can call hospice.
Mm.
More often than not, it's the physicians, but the family can call and neighbors can call. We've had ministers from church call. Now we need to get doctor's orders from the treating physician in order for the person to come in to hospice. But
when you say come into hospice, it could be you going to them.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I know that's confusing terminology. Yes, my going to them. Exactly.
You're talking about coming into the system. Well, tell me, if you've been through, say, 2,000 passings
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
far,
mm-hmm.
and we want to get to your books in a minute, but
mm-hmm.
do you ever cry? I mean, do you ever get caught?
I cry all the time.
How good. Well, that's good to hear, because it's like
cry all the time. There was one patient in particular. She was a dying young mother, single mom, and she had to give her kids away. I mean, it was just a heartbreaking situation. And it got so bad that I used to see her at the end of the day, and I tied a rope around my neck with a roll of toilet paper. And she just laughed herself silly when I walked in, because we were crying so much, the two of us, that we could never find a Kleenex. So I used to wear the roll of toilet paper around my neck when I went to see her. And it just, you know, it just gave a little bit of humor. Of course you cry, you know, you... It's difficult. What we do is difficult, but the amount of gratification that you made such a difference
mm-hmm.
outweighs it all.
Well, I'm sure you feel the love of people who feel... I mean, my thing a lot of times is I do a lot of healing work, and
uh-huh.
people seem to be healed in a certain emotional way when they're seen and known for who they are.
Exactly.
And I think in the dying process, that's probably rare, is it?
Not in hospice.
No. Well, not in a conscious hospice, I suppose.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, one of the chapters in my new book is Don't Ask the Dentist to Deliver Your Baby. Well, now, isn't that, see, no explanation is needed there. It's perfectly obvious. What a ridiculous thing to do. But what most
right.
people don't realize is that not all doctors are trained in the special needs of the care of the dying.
Right.
And, you know... people are very careful, you know, which dealer gets their car for servicing, and yet we're not very careful about how we choose the people who will take care of our needs as our life comes to a close.
But I think I understand that logically, not heartfeltly, but mm-hmm. when people are given a death sentence, put it in those terms, people kind of just give up in a way, don't they?
Or sometimes they refuse hospice because what it stands for.
Right.
You know, they think it's kind of a revolving door, but you only get in, you never get out kind of thing, which is not true. We are discharging more patients than we ever used to in the beginning, because in the beginning hospice served primarily cancer because cancer was and continues to be curable.
Hmm.
You know, it's, you know, they've already figured out about how long, how much time is left when this happens and how much time is left when that happens. And that was not always true with things like heart disease and lung disease and birth defects. And so, you know, it's broadened quite a bit, and we can make a good improvement. In fact, one of the patients that I took care of for 2.5 years came in and out of hospice 3 times.
Oh, my.
And she kept saying, I'm going to keep at this till I get it right. But she had lung, she had COPD or emphysema, very severe.
Mm.
And once we gave her her little bottle of liquid morphine and allowed her to medicate herself with a drop or two under her tongue, when she started feeling like she couldn't breathe, the quality of her life skyrocketed.
So that would bring up enthusiasm and all kinds.
Oh, my God. Well, because the whole fear factor was gone, because
right.
she was in charge.
Right.
And, you know, we asked her to keep very close records of what she was giving. And traditionally, I mean, consistently across the board, she medicated herself less than we would have.
Hmm.
But see, it was the control.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the biggest fears of people when they think about dying is the powerlessness aspect.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that's something that we work very hard to ease in hospice by giving people as much control and power as possible.
So tell us about your book, Final Journeys, because I believe it is kind of practical information about that kind of thing. Like, how do you deal with the dying and what
exactly.
kind of family stuff?
Well, I wrote 2 books and I did it backward. The first book, Final Gifts, was a collaboration with Patricia Kelly, and that's about the language, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Understanding what we think is confused language is really not confused, mm. but rather powerful messages of what the dying is experiencing. So we wrote that book in 92, and suddenly the top blew off the world, and my life changed 100%. Well, actually not, because I continue to work, but we just had no idea. It's now in 11 languages, and it
wow.
seems that we just framed something that's been going on for a long time, and nobody had sort of labeled it and named it and said, well, when it happens, this is what we suggest you do. So, but then there was a point after that where I started feeling guilty that we had made everything too sweet. Because it is, the confusion of the dying and the things that they say are often extremely uplifting messages. I'm not alone. I'm with my mother who died. I see where I'm going. It's a place I want to go. You know, these are very comforting messages for the family.
But they're comforting, but thumbnail in a context that could be a lot more dramatic. Eh?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Okay, I just say it's like a thumbnail, a very wonderful thumbnail sketch
yes.
in a
yes.
much more complex picture.
Exactly. And I started feeling guilty because it's a hard job. And I was feeling bad for caregivers and thinking, you know, nobody talks about the nasty parts of it and the hard parts of it and families that go crazy with each other and doctors who won't listen and how to get your opinion, you know, how to get people to listen to you, how to do, you know, how to know what choices that you can have. Let's see what else.
I love some of your headings for each chapter.
How to include children, and please do that as early as possible, because they will be far more frightened if they are excluded. But, you know, how to talk to somebody. Well, some of the chapter headings, I tried to give a little humor because I learned early on that dying did not need me to make it more serious.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the chapters is called Don't Tell Mom She's Dying, It'll Kill Her. And this is that whole conspiracy of silence. Nobody talks about it. It's the big hippopotamus in the middle of the room with a tutu on, and nobody says a word about it. They just walk around it. And, well, that's because of, you know, because they don't know what to do. I'm not being critical. They're just, it's emotionally wrought. They're afraid to make the dying.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is a taboo, but they're afraid that they're going to make the dying person cry, or they're afraid that they're going to cry, or, you know, they just don't know what to say. And that causes much greater sense of isolation on the part of the dying.
Mm-hmm.
Because then they feel like they've got to take care of you because you're so uncomfortable and you don't know what to say. And you come in and say, don't you look great today? Well, the dying person knows they don't at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the message that they are given is, I can't deal with the awful thing that's happening to you, so you better take care of me.
Mm-hmm.
And so the dying person, you know, kicks into the, yeah, I know, and it's a good day. And but there is no true communication going on here. There's
so how do you talk to children about all that?
Right, and when do you introduce it, and on what level? The second book, which is Final Journeys, I have an extensive bibliography in the back about books that are appropriate for children according to their developmental stages. Because we know with children, up until about the age of 7 or 8, their concept of death is not permanent.
Hmm.
It's, well, my grandma will come back. You know, it's they're still into the magical thinking.
Hmm.
So you need to, you know, deal with them appropriate to what they can handle. So there's a lot of information on that. But, you know, I talk about getting your paperwork in order. You know, the best thing you can do for your family actually right now, as soon as this show is over, get your paperwork together. Make your wishes known. Because when something happens to you, your family is so distraught. And, you know, I know my kids don't have any medical training, and that's a huge burden to have them have to decide whether or not to stop a respirator.
Mm.
You know, these are things that can really damage people for the rest of their lives. So, you know, it's easier to talk about how I want my final journey to go now when death is not sitting on my front doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, my kids know I want bagpipes. They know I'm going to need some lead time to put new Post-its on the fridge. You know, I want to give away the jewelry. You know, these kind of things. Important to do that.
Let me ask you about a child. I know of a 5-year-old whose family friend died recently of a heart attack at 33.
Oh,
and he was
wow.
And he was a friend of the little boy, and they didn't tell him for about 3 weeks.
Oh.
And then they told him, but the question, and I was told about that today, so I thought it's a perfect question to ask you. How
right.
would you recommend that people deal with that kind of thing with a child to
okay.
not create fear?
I think it's very, I'm a very simple, direct person. It's what
sure.
I call information McNuggets. And I believe in being very honest with children because they're too smart to know when you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And because you get tripped up in,
mm-hmm.
you know, sugarcoating things. And because the child needs to watch your grief to learn the normal way of grieving.
Mm.
Okay. So if this dear friend dies, is never mentioned for 3 weeks, nobody says his name because they're afraid to tip the balance and everybody bursts into tears. Nobody cries. What kind of a message is that to the child?
Right.
Okay. Somebody we really, really loved is gone, but we're not even going to address it. Don't you address it either. Don't you cry either. So I'm not being critical of the parents because parents know their children better than anybody. And a lot of times we want to protect children. But in
well, they wanted to protect him, apparently. This is irrelevant, I think, to what we're talking about.
Okay.
That they wanted to protect him because they felt they were way too emotional and they wanted to get their act together before they told him. And
so what did they do? Where was the child while they were being emotional?
Came and stayed with his grandmother, me.
Ah.
While they traveled for the funeral.
Ah.
And the point is, and it was interesting when they told him yesterday, that's right, the first person he called was me, and he wouldn't talk to me. He just started crying and told me what had happened. And then he said to his mom, he promised to come to my birthday party. So I thought that was a pretty clear response on his part.
Well, and don't be surprised if he is waiting for him to come to the birthday party because he's only 5.
Yeah.
And we do magic things with people we love. We make them big and powerful and superhero-like, and, you know, so don't be surprised by any of that. And there's some terrific books for kids. Story, kids learn so well through books and stories. Mm-hmm. And as I say, I'm not being critical. It's just the more honest, and the parents will be giving this child a gift if they weep in front of him and they share how sad they are. And, you know, if just driving in a car 2 months from now on the way to the grocery store and mom says, you know, I was just thinking about Jerry and I feel so sad. Mm-hmm. Allows the child to share the same thing.
Right.
So they don't
And draw pictures and stuff too, right?
Sure. And put a picture up on the refrigerator so that we can remember him, and put pictures of him with the little boy, and, you know, all of that is very healthy. And then immediately the child thinks, but will mommy and daddy die of heart attacks?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of that reassurance, we're very, very healthy, and it shouldn't happen, and you don't need to worry. But we have made absolutely sure that you will always be taken care of and protected by someone who loves you, whatever their plans are.
That's a very important issue for families, sure, of all kinds, isn't it?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the big fear for the child is, who's going to take care of me? Is this going to keep happening?
Mm-hmm.
So... you know, hats off for them for trying to get their ducks in a row and eventually telling him. And it's hard when it's someone so young, it's so unjust. I believe in taking children to funerals.
Yeah, I do too, actually.
But I know when my dad died, he was the first grandparent to die, we took the kids to the viewing. But we had a private family viewing.
Hmm.
And my son needed to open the bottom of the casket, mm-hmm, and was extremely distressed that granddad didn't have shoes on.
Oh.
So we immediately got in the car and went right home and got the shoes.
Oh, that's
and nice. Had to delay the public viewing a little bit while we put the shoes on. And my son wanted them polished.
How old is your son?
At the time, he was 9.
Okay.
Yeah. And he wanted to touch, and he was distressed by the difference of the feel.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, see, that's the difference between being alive and not being alive. And we talked about the package, that the body's just the package. Mm-hmm. And that the spirit is like the butterfly now. And, you know, there's a whole lot you can do. I was very guarded and protective of keeping the kids away from what I call the cheek pinchers.
All right.
You know, there's always people at a funeral who, because they can't think of what to say the absolute worst thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, you're the man of the family now to a 10-year-old whose father died. Oh,
mm-hmm,
please.
Really? Mm-hmm.
Bad enough to lose your father, you know. So I think,
like,
children,
you say, they're very smart. And my grandson said, that's the first person that died, which he meant in his world. And that was after crying. I thought that was pretty wise. And,
well, because often for a little kid, it's a goldfish.
Yeah.
You know, so he's absolutely right. But you see, in his mind, he's getting the fact that this will happen again and that this is sort of part of life.
Yeah.
Pretty advanced for a 5-year-old. But, of course, you know that as a grandmother, right?
Right, of course, my grandest one. But
I need to tell you, though, when about 3 weeks after my father died, my son and daughter and I were riding to the grocery store, and from the back seat, this little voice said, "You know what, Mom?" And I said, "What, Eric?" And he said, "When I think of granddad, I get lonely in my throat."
Oh, isn't that wonderful?
Does that capture it?
Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh, you know what? I do too." And then we cried. We sat in the parking lot of the grocery store, and we cried, and then we went in and we bought cookies.
Well, that's the best thing, because not just the cookies, but the spontaneity, I think, is what heals the grief the best.
Well, and that's why it's important not to keep children away,
mm-hmm,
you know, because they don't know how to grieve. They don't know how they're supposed to do this. And the only people that can teach them are those of us who go ahead of them.
That's right.
And they are incredibly smart, and if we could all grieve the way children do, they grieve intensely, sometimes flipping onto the floor, hanging backwards out of the rocking chair, sobbing, making noise, and then they get up and want to know what's for lunch.
Very practical.
It's so normal and healthy.
But Maggie, there's something I want you to tell people about is you're dealing with your own grief about these people that you love and the tears that you shed on the way across the bridge.
These people that I love. Now, you're talking about my patients.
Yeah. And I asked you, are we allowed to talk about this?
Sure, sure, sure.
I asked you about crying, and you told me this amazing story.
Okay, well, I'm not sure this is the amazing story I told you, but this is the story you're going to hear now.
I'm sure you have many amazing stories.
Is it the toll booth story?
Yeah.
Well, Okay, all right, yes. Yes, I noticed wonderful colleagues that were gifted and talented and I loved to work with were crashing and burning around me, and I needed to find out why, because if it was a virus or something, I needed to get inoculated, or, you know, I just didn't want it to happen to me. And so I really kind of dissected each one of them, and what I came to realize was that there were two parts of that, and part of it was that they just didn't take the time to grieve, and the other part really was that they didn't have good boundaries. You know, what work creeped into their lives, and, you know, the boundaries got blurry, and you need to be very clear when the job stops and when you go have fun, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I thought grieving. Okay, I need to grieve.
Like the kid says, it's time for a sandwich now.
I need to grieve. We got to get this grieving thing done. And, you know, I didn't want to come home to my kids every day in tears. And so anyway, I chose the Dulles Toll Road. For any of you who have been in the Washington, D.C. area, it leads from Dulles Airport down into the city. And it and the town that I lived in was halfway down the toll road. So I chose the toll road that spanned the last, 8 miles of my trip home, that I would grieve on the toll road. I got so good at this, Veronica, that as I would approach the toll road, I would start. And half the time I didn't even know what specific thing I was grieving for, but the tears would start. And I don't mean just sniffle, sniffle, daub, daub with a Kleenex. I mean open mouth wail.
Oh, good for you.
Well, you know, the better you do it, the less it controls you.
That's right.
I mean, find the woods and go scream. You know, just don't let it stay in there and percolate. So I'd be heading to the main toll booths, wailing like a banshee, and missing the basket with my quarter, and the guy was like, never mind, it's okay, I'll get it. He's always running out after me and picking up my... And this went on and on and on. In fact, I don't even work in Northern Virginia anymore, but when I hit the toll road, I start to cry. I learned this so well.
That's your Pavlovian response.
It was such a good thing to do. So anyway, so I'm weeping and wailing and missing the basket with my change, and one day I was sent to admit this lovely lady in the town past mine on the toll road. And this was a wonderful big Irish family, and I thought, oh, these are the land of my people, you know, this is going to be great. We also had a doctor in our area, and it wasn't, how can I say this so he doesn't sound like a total jerk? He just didn't have the heart to tell his dying patients that there was nothing more he could do for them.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd send me. He'd send hospice. And so you'd ring the doorbell and the family would open the door, and there you are with a great big name tag that says Maggie Callanan Hospice.
Oh my God.
And the family's like, what?
Oh no.
Not nice. Not nice to them, not nice to me. We did take a party platter to his office one lunchtime and discussed the issue, shall we say. So anyway, I rang the doorbell. This young fellow opens the door, and he's looking at me, and he looks at my name tag, and suddenly he has this face of horror. And I'm thinking, darn it all again, it's Dr. So-and-so. And I was irritated. I thought, I'm never going to get in this house. This was like 10 minutes where he's standing there with the open door in his hand, and we're looking at each other. And then he starts to look familiar. He was one of the toll booth operators.
Oh, God.
And
he recognized you?
Finally, he put the pieces together. And after I admitted his mother, he walked me out to the car when I was done. And he said, you have no idea how much we talked about you. He said every break we were talking about the lady in the silver car who was just weeping and wailing and what in the world was going on in her life that was so awful every single day.
Oh, wow.
He said we had a new toll booth operator. He was a young kid, and he thought we should do something to help you because you were probably in trouble. So he was just waiting for a day that you'd come into his lane, and he was going to scream, "Dump the bum!" But from that point on, every time I went through the toll booths, I'd hear, "Hi, nurse, hi," and somebody would blow a whistle. I mean, suddenly now, I shared a journey with 7 or 8 total strangers.
Oh, that wonderful. It sounds like they were really compassionate.
They were very compassionate, and it was a pleasure to take care of this family. And he said, "Now I get it. I really get it."
We have to end this soon. And
no,
we're just getting warmed up. And
I have too much to say.
Yes, you and you're very. What is it? You put the humor in it. You know, I know I've been with people who are on the verge of passing, and we do end up laughing sometimes, you know.
Yeah, well, funny people die funny. There's one point I want to make. This is important for the audience to know.
Please.
Dying people die as they live. Funny people die funny. Busy people are busy. Organized people get very organized. Happy people are happier. Mean people get meaner. And buckle your seatbelt if you've got a manipulator on your hands. Because these are the crutches that we were given at birth to carry us through life. And death is the ultimate crisis, and we really intensify our crutch then. So to just know that the person that you're dealing with, that you already have a sense of their personality, multiply that by 10, and that's what is realistic to expect.
Wow,
isn't that interesting?
And that doesn't change, eh?
Well, I'm sure that there's an exception here or there, but, I mean, it's across the board as far as I've been able to see.
Now, and another question I want to ask you, being an intuitive and all, is what about deathbed visions and that sort of thing? Have you?
Well, that's what all Final Gifts is written about. My colleague Pat Kelly and I started noticing interesting patterns of behavior and gestures and confused language on the part of our dying patients. Because I had been in critical care and had been involved in more resuscitations than I can even tell you.
And probably a lot of near-death experience.
Well, and because I was there, you know, the nurses left to clean up the room while you're waiting for the patient to get their bed on ICU. So, yes, I was there when many of what I prefer to call the travelers returned and heard what they said. And then I read Dr. Raymond Moody's book, Life After Life, which is sort of the landmark book. He's the father of the term near-death experience. And his first two books I highly recommend. He's gone off into different tangents that I can't speak to because I'm not on those tangents. But the first two books really kind of changed our view of death and dying. So I was very aware of that. Pat was also aware of that for different reasons. And I remember having lunch with her at a table. I mean, this is unusual for us as nurses. It's usually a cheeseburger in your lap while you drive from one house to the other. And she said to me, you know, there's a gentleman that I'm taking care of. And her territory was way down near Mount Vernon in Washington. I was way out in the country. And she said he's very worried about his tickets and how he's going to get to the airport and can he catch the plane and where's his passport and where's his papers. And it's making his wife crazy. She's irritated at him because she can't get him, you know, he's not going anywhere. So he's, quote, confused. And I said, well, you know, I have a dying young mother in my part of the town and she's worried about the car. Where's the license? Is there oil, you know, air in the tires, blah, blah. Clearly, these people are talking about getting ready for a journey. And so we started looking at these kind of stories, and they're profound. Profound messages about what it feels like to die. Dying people don't care about their blood pressure and their electrolytes. They're talking about the experience of dying. And our dying patients are telling us that they're not alone, that people that they loved or spiritual beings are there with them, that they see a place that they're going and it's a place they're excited about, has a lot of lifestyle parallels. A golfer will talk about a wonderful tournament. That they actually know when they're dying. This is one of those situations that we'd like to believe the dying people don't know they're dying, so we shouldn't have to talk about it. But in fact, they do know.
And they don't they choose their time?
Yes,
somebody
they do.
Somebody said that if they want to die alone, you'll be out of the room.
That's right. Or you go to the bathroom or you fall asleep in the chair.
Wow.
So it's in the hands of the dying, so don't do a guilt number on yourself. They will wait for you if you're not there. And if you are and they want to die by themselves, they'll wait till you fall asleep or go to the bathroom. So
and
you
we
just
have
don't
to
get
say
crazy.
Goodnight. And
no!
Your books are Final Gifts and Final Journey, and this is Maggie Callanan. And
thank
I know
you.
Everybody, you need to check these books out and need to take a tour into understanding more about that process that you've worked on so well. Thank you
and
so much.
And I appreciate
much.
The opportunity, Veronica.
Oh, me too. And would you like to give your website?
My website is MaggieCallanan.com.
Well, that's easy. And Maggie will
just
be in
don't
touch.
Put an H in Callahan. It's not. It's Callanan.
Oh, good. Thank you for that.
Yes.
And many blessings, and we'll be in
thank
touch.
You. Thank you. Thank you, Veronica.
Time.
Take care.
Good night.
Good night.